headlines. Trump's supporters gather in Washington to hear the defeated president's election fraud cries amid fears of violence. Iran's army stages the final phase of its maneuvers, deploying hundreds of indigenous drones in the country's north-central province. And mourners in Pakistan refuse to bury miners killed by Daesh terrorists as they protest for a fourth day, demanding better protection. Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Supporters of U.S. President Donald Trump have gathered in Washington, D.C. ahead of the congressional certification of Joe Biden's win in the November 3rd election. Trump is expected to address his supporters and decry the certification of Biden as the winner. He has repeatedly claimed that the election was rigged in favor of his Democratic contender. Trump has not conceded his defeat, despite losing dozens of court efforts seeking to reverse the presidential election results. Meanwhile, authorities in the U.S. Capitol have beefed up security amid Trump's call for his supporters to throng the city. National Guard troops have also been mobilized to control the crowd. D.C. police have so far arrested several people carrying firearms and attacking law enforcement officers. Meanwhile, Democrats are on the path to victory in the Senate runoff elections in the U.S. state of Georgia, with approximately all the votes counted. U.S. media have projected Democrat Raphael Warnock as the winner of one of the two runoffs against Republican Senator Amy Loeffler. In the other contest, Democrat John Ossoff has claimed victory over the incumbent Republican David Perdue. The outcome of the Georgia elections will determine which party would gain control of the Senate. Republicans need the victory of either of their candidates to preserve the majority in the Senate. Democrats, however, must gain control over both seats to capture a majority in both houses of the U.S. Congress.
The fate of which party controls the United States Senate hangs on the outcome of two runoff elections in the state of Georgia, but both races are too close to call in yet another American election shrouded in controversy. Both runoffs appear headed for a long and bitter dispute, just like the presidential election. Polls show that 2 months after going to the ballot box, around 40% of voters believe that Joe Biden's projected victory is illegitimate. The disputes revolve around allegations of widespread but unproven mass voter fraud, but also the historically unprecedented use of early voting and mail-in ballots due to the coronavirus pandemic.
There's legitimate concerns, frankly, and I learned this as a third-party candidate, with early voting and mail-in voting, because it means that the people are reached in their living rooms, that people make their voting decision watching television. And it's been a historical tradition in the United States that people go to the polls and politicians and their surrogates go to the polls and they try to persuade people. And they say, I know Chris Krueger and I think he's a good guy and I think you should vote for him and have a face-to-face. I think face-to-face communication is an important thing that we're transitioning from.
Early estimates say the Georgia campaigns have spent around $900 million combined, which exceeds the total amount of every presidential race until the year 2000.
In the November elections, 90% of congressional races were won by the candidate who spent the most money. The elections also featured a record use of so-called dark money, where the source of campaign funding is not disclosed.
A major reason why the United States has such a seemingly unbreakable two-party duopoly is because cold, hard cash plays such a big role in who gets elected.
The candidates that have the most money to spend on television ads, or the candidates that in fact have tremendous media adherence, almost ideological adherence in the media, they reach the voters. For a third-party candidate, for an independent candidate, for a Green, for a Libertarian, or for any other third party trying to run, it's very hard to reach voters.
It's not clear who will win the Georgia congressional races, control of the Senate, or the presidency.
What does appear clear is that any possible outcome will likely not be accepted by almost half the country, and that America's bitter political divisions look dangerously locked in for the next 4 years. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Ambulance workers in the West City of Los Angeles, California, have reportedly ordered to stop transporting patients with severe conditions as hospitals are overwhelmed with COVID-infected people. California has become the new COVID epicenter and is experiencing the worst since the beginning of the pandemic. Health officials say that a massive surge of cases has battered the state's healthcare system with shortage of oxygen and intensive care unit beds. LA officials have described the situation as a human disaster, saying that healthcare workers are physically and mentally exhausted and sick. Almost 8,000 people were hospitalized with COVID in Los Angeles County alone on Tuesday, 21% of them in ICUs. The county has so far registered over 11,000 deaths. The U.S. remains the world's worst-hit country, with over 21 million cases and more than 357,000 deaths. Iran's army has held the final phase of its maneuvers that used hundreds of indigenous UAVs. The military exercises are aimed at organizing and enhancing the preparation of Iran's army in drone combats. Yusuf Jalali has more.
All divisions of Iran's army are engaged in a full-scale war with a simulated enemy. This is the second and final day of the Iranian army drills held in central Iran. There's no direct confrontation, as the Iranian military carries out all its attacks remotely, using these pilotless aircraft. On the last phase of the drill, the army used its surveillance drones to track suspicious activities along its borders while deploying its combat drones to the conflict area, where they destroyed their targets.
The main focus of attention in this drill was to attack distant hostile targets. As part of the exercise, we flew UAVs from our southern borders where they must target mobile objects in our country's central areas. All of our goals were met in this maneuver.
Iran stepped into the realm of UAVs in 2011 after it captured U.S. spy drone RQ-170 on its northeastern borders. It later produced copies of the captured UAV in different sizes, the last of which has an edge over its American peer. It has fighting features as well. But that was not where it ends. Iran's ambitions in the unmanned aircraft got the country to a level where it produces a variety of operational drones. One of the latest is this beast called Muhajir 6, which is a combat drone equipped with two seeker bombs that can lock onto their low-altitude air targets.
Today, Iran is the only regional power in terms of the drone technology. The UAVs that you saw today are made based on cutting-edge technology. Our UAVs are capable of conducting a variety of missions in different ranges and altitudes.
The drill comes as Iran and the U.S. have been engaged in a war of words, raising concerns about a potential conflict. Iran's military officials rapped the U.S. for, quote, its military adventurism in the Persian Gulf, while pressing that they're prepared for any scenario.
Unfortunately, the U.S. military has recently carried out some provocative movements in the region. It has deployed its long-range aircraft to the region in what it calls a show of power. American officials have also made some accusations against the Islamic Republic. Now, this drill shows the readiness of our armed forces to defend our country's borders from air, land, and sea against any aggression.
Military officials say this drill sends a message of peace and security for regional states, while assuring their neighbors that the Islamic Republic's military doctrine is based on deterrence, not aggression. Iran's army says the drill drew a clear map of its strategies to manage UAV-based attacks and counterattacks in real-time war scenarios. Given the recent trade of threats between Iran and its enemies, the Iranian army says this maneuver sends a strong message that Iran's borders are safer with its drones. Yusuf Jalali from the location of the drill.
The commander of the Quds Force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has vowed harsh revenge for the assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani.
Our duty is clear. First is to take revenge from the murderers that committed this heinous crime. The revenge began at the very first moment that they assassinated top resistance commanders, and it will reach its end point. But this revenge has several steps. The enemy has been slapped twice and will be slapped two more times in the future. The first was the huge funeral procession that was held for General Soleimani and his comrades. The second was an attack on the U.S. base in Iraq that broke the grandeur of America. The third slap will be when the U.S. hegemony will be defeated. And the last one will be the U.S. withdrawal from the region.
Brigadier General Ghani was speaking at a ceremony marking the first anniversary of Soleimani's assassination. The ceremony took place in Soleimani's hometown, Kerman, in southern Iran. Ghani said that U.S. forces will be crushed first, and then they will be expelled from the West Asia region. He said the perpetrators of the crime will not be safe, even in their own homes. The Iranian commander said the path of General Soleimani will continue. Soleimani was killed in a U.S. drone attack in Iraq last January. The head of Iraq's Popular Mobilization Forces says that Iran's top general Qasem Soleimani and the Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Mohandas defeated the enemies even with their martyrdom.
The night of their martyrdom, they were able to achieve the greatest victory, great victory, to try to move the emotions of the people, to show people to realize how great they were. They were able to revive. Is there much greater than these meanings? The martyrdom is a weapon in order to preserve the nation, preserve peace. This is greater than nuclear weapons. Martyrdom, this is how they defeat their enemies. This is how the faithful defeat their enemies through martyrdom.
Fadi al-Fayyad was addressing a ceremony marking the first anniversary of the U.S. assassination of Soleimani and Mohandas. He hailed the two commanders for their sacrifices in bringing security to the region. The PMU leader referred the two anti-terror icons to great political and military figures. He underlined that Soleimani and Mohandas were like loyal brothers, and they could be role models for the youth. General Soleimani and Mohandas were assassinated near Baghdad airport by a U.S. drone strike ordered by President Trump last January. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has blamed the U.S. for last year's downing of a Ukrainian passenger plane. In a statement marking the anniversary of the plane crash, the IRGC said Washington's, quote, inhumane adventurism and terrorist actions led to the tragedy. The IRGC expressed its deepest sadness over the disaster and vowed to defeat the country's enemies and exact a hard revenge against what it called the global hegemony. In January of last year, a Ukrainian passenger jet was shot down near Tehran after Iran's air defense mistook the flight with an invading missile. That happened 5 days after Iran fired ballistic missiles at a U.S. military base in Iraq, following Washington's assassination of top Iranian commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Iran's ambassador to Vienna-based international organizations has warned against the consequences of Israel's clandestine nuclear weapons program. Qasem Gharibabadi issued the warning in a letter to Rafael Grossi, the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency. The letter said the expansion of Israel's secret nuclear program not only poses a serious threat to global security and stability, but also to the effectiveness and efficiency of the NPT and the agency's safeguards regime. It also said that the IAEA should explicitly and categorically call upon Israel to place all of its nuclear materials and facilities under the agency's comprehensive safeguards without any preconditions. Israel has never allowed any inspection of its nuclear facilities and continues to defy international calls to join the NPT. Israel is widely believed to possess up to 200 nuclear warheads. Members of the Shia Hazara community in Pakistan's Balochistan province continue their protests for a fourth day over the Daesh-claimed brutal killing of 11 minors. The protesters slammed the killing as a systematic ethnic cleansing of Hazaras in Balochistan. They accused security forces of doing nothing to protect them. The demonstrators have blocked a road in the provincial capital of Quetta with the coffins of slain miners. They are refusing to bury the victims until their demands are met, which include the resignation of the provincial government. People have also held a protest in the port city of Karachi to condemn the killing. On Sunday, Daesh terrorists brutally killed the miners in a residential compound near a coal mine. Hundreds of Hazaras have been killed over the last decade in gun and bomb attacks in Pakistan. Islamabad correspondent Javed Rana says although the government has vowed to battle Daesh elements and bring them to justice, it is difficult to stop them attacking the Hazara community.
That given the fact that there have been repeated incidents, now they are refusing to bury down their loved ones. They are saying that until the Prime Minister himself comes over there and gives them assurance. And I think this is a demand way upon which the Prime Minister has reacted, and he is saying he has given assurance or to the Hazara community members that he's going to visit them soon, but now it is a time to bury their loved ones, because it is very difficult for them to stay in a cold weather conditions, and they have been there on the roads for last couple of days. Prime Minister has sent his interior minister, who has given them assurance that the killers would be arrested. But unfortunately, since these Daesh terrorists are transnationals, they are not confined to a particular community in Pakistan. Finding them is something easier said than done. But generally, they have a back and forth movement to Afghanistan, which shares Pakistan's borders from the Balochistan province. So I think it will take time for the security forces to crack them down. They have the sleeper cells in Pakistan. They have camouflaged themselves in the communities. So it will certainly take time.
Bahrain's top Shia cleric, Grand Ayatollah Sheikh Isa Hassan, has lashed out at the Al-Khalifa regime for curtailing freedom in the kingdom. In a statement, Sheikh Hassan accused the Bahraini regime of stifling the voices of people and violating their right to freedom of expression. The cleric said the Bahrainis face the most severe forms of punishment for expressing their opinions. He described the kingdom as an oversized prison filled with smaller prisons that strip people of their freedom and rights. Hassan, however, declared that righteousness will eventually prevail. Bahrainis have witnessed widespread crackdowns since a popular uprising in 2011. Manama has since killed hundreds of activists, detained thousands, and sent many of them into exile or revoked their citizenship. Bahraini authorities also stripped Sheikh Isa Hassan of his citizenship in 2016. The Yemeni Petroleum Company has slammed Saudi Arabia and its allies with a blockade in a press conference. It says that the siege is causing the company millions of dollars and has led to the death of innocent civilians. More details from our correspondent in Sana'a, Abdul Latif Al-Washali.
The executive director of Yemen's petroleum company has held a press conference in the capital Sana'a over Saudi Arabia's blockade. The officials say the company lost over $100 million in 2020 due to the Saudi-led coalition violations and siege, and accused the UN of complicity.
The United Nations is providing cover for the Saudi-led coalition's acts of piracy in international waters, and it bears full responsibility for them. The violations are huge, and the fines we have suffered are immense.
The senior official said nearly two dozen petrol ships belonging to Yemen's petroleum company were confiscated by Saudi Arabia in 2020. He said the seizures came despite the fact that the ships all had transit permits from the UN. Yemen's petroleum company said the ships were released after a few months, but Saudi Arabia's quota acts of piracy cost them millions of dollars in delay fines.
The United Nations has become a clear partner in this blockade against the Yemeni people and has come to stand by the coalition of aggression, so it bears responsibility for the humanitarian crisis.
Yemeni officials say the confiscation of ships caused a spike in fuel prices and forced the closure of some services. They also say the delays and lack of fuel pushed the medical sector to collapse and caused a humanitarian crisis. Many people have to wait for days to get fuel for their vehicle and the limited number of petrol stations.
Saudi Arabia's blockade of Yemen has led to the deaths of Yemeni people and is pushing the country further toward what the UN describes as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. This has taken place amid the silence of international organizations. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
British court has denied bail to WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange as he awaits the outcome of a U.S. appeal of the decision to block his extradition. The judge in charge of the case said that there is a possibility that Assange could abscond. The Australian journalist had requested bail after the judge ruled on Monday that he should not return to the U.S. Washington appealed the ruling. Assange is accused of illegally hacking into U.S. government websites and leaking documents containing war crimes in Afghanistan and Iraq. Washington claims the leaks broke into law and endangered lives. Assange and his legal team have long argued that the case is politically motivated. He has spent the last 8 years in Britain trying to avoid being extradited to the U.S., where he faces espionage charges. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The pardoning of four Blackwater mercenaries by U.S. President Donald Trump was an action that violated international law, a group of experts at the United Nations said recently. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Chris Walker Ryder. This article is published under the heading, UN Experts Say Trump Violated International Law in Pardoning Blackwater Mercenaries. Here's the details of this article. The pardoning of four Blackwater mercenaries by U.S. President Donald Trump was an action that violated international law, a group of experts at the United Nations said recently. Trump pardoned the four contractors, including Nicholas Sladen, who was convicted of first-degree murder, as well as Paul Slough, Ivan Liberty, and Dustin Hurd, all three who were convicted of voluntary and attempt manslaughter, as part of more than a dozen pardons and commutations. Those contractors were convicted for opening fire on a crowd and killing a number of individuals in 2007 in what has become known as the Nisour Square Massacre in Baghdad, Iraq. 17 unarmed Iraqi citizens were killed in total. The youngest victim in that shooting, Ali Kanani, was just 9 years old when he was killed by the four Blackwater contractors. His father, Muhammad Kanani, recounted the scene he witnessed when the massacre happened. Muhammad Kanani said, "When one man tried to run, they shot him," Kanani said in a Democracy Now! Interview from 2010. He dropped dead on the spot. He was on the ground, bleeding, and they were shooting nonstop. They shot like they were trying to kill everyone they could. Due to how vicious and criminal these men's actions were, members of the UN condemned Trump's decision to pardon them, describing his actions as criminal while doing so. Pardoning the Blackwater contractors is an affront to justice and to the victims of the Nisour Square massacre and their families. Jelena Aparak, chair of a UN working group on the use of mercenaries, said recently of Trump's pardoning of the four Blackwater contractors. The President of the United States has tremendous leeway when it comes to whom they may pardon. However, many scholars believe there are still limits to the pardon power, particularly when it comes to consideration for other laws, including international agreements and treaties, which are treated as the supreme law of the land according to the U.S. Constitution. In that respect, it's possible that Trump violated the Geneva Conventions when he pardoned these four individuals, as member states to that agreement are responsible for holding war criminals in their own country accountable for their actions. Private contractors or mercenaries are included in those Geneva Conventions agreements. There are grave consequences, according to those agreements, for not adhering to this rule, ignoring or curtailing punishments for war criminals. Will likely encourage other nations, for instance, to hire private contractors in order to break the spirit of the international agreement. With that in mind, the pardons are in violation of U.S. obligations under international law and will undermine humanitarian law and human rights at a global level, Aparak, the UN expert, said. Ensuring accountability for such crimes is fundamental to humanity and to the community of nations, Aparak elaborated, adding that pardons, amnesties, or any other forms of exculpation for war crimes open doors to future abuses when states contract private military and security companies for inherent state functions. Marjorie Kahn, Professor Emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and Deputy Secretary General of the International Association of Democratic Lawyers, expressed similar sentiments. Kahn, speaking directly to the reporters about the matter, also said that Trump should have pardoned WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange for his role in revealing other atrocities of U.S. military in the years past. The Geneva Conventions require that the states hold war crimes criminals accountable, Kahn said. Yet Trump pardoned four war criminals, but indicted Julian Assange for revealing evidence of U.S. war crimes and criminals in Iraq. Kahn continued, Assange published the collateral murder video, which depicts U.S. troops killing 18 civilians in violation of the Geneva Conventions. Trump should dismiss the indictment against Assange and grant him a full pardon.
Ocean of Dua.
سلوك الهدى والتقى والعفاف والغنى.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear listeners, brothers and sisters, I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Rarsi, and we're gonna be with you with another edition of The Ocean of Dua. In this version of the program, inshallah, we will discuss the true meaning of prayer and dua, the value of prayer, ways of reaching the Almighty Allah, acceptance and also benefits of dua. So stay with us. Dear brothers and sisters, since you have been previously with us, you already know that we were talking about the three means with which we can seek recourse to the Almighty Allah in our supplications. The first means was the neediness. I assume we sufficiently talked about this point, this means actually, and we concluded that we have to comprehend and recognize this neediness that attracts the mercy of Almighty Allah within the frameworks of this divine system we're living in. And we have examples throughout the Holy Quran, instances of the presentation of neediness and poverty before Allah, and they are done in order to attract His mercy, in order to attain the response from the Almighty Allah.
رَبَّنَا آتِنَا فِي الدُّنْيَا حَسَنَةً وَفِي الْآخِرَةِ حَسَنَةً وَقِنَا عَذَابَ النَّارِ وَقِنَا عَذَابَ النَّارِ.
At first, the neediness of the Prophet Ayyub, the righteous servants of Allah, when he called upon Allah amidst the affliction and trial, the Holy Quran says in this regard, وَأَيُّوبَ إِذْ نَادَ رَبَّهُ أَنِّي مَسَّنِيَ الضُّرُّ وَأَنْتَ أَرْحَمُ الرَّاحِمِينَ. And Ayyub, when he called out to his Lord, indeed distress has befallen me, and you are the most merciful of the merciful. The Holy Quran in the next verse says, فَاسْتَجَبْنَا لَهُ فَكَشَفْنَا مَا بِهِ مِنَ الضُّرُّ. So we answered his prayer, and we removed his distress. وَأَتَيْنَاهُ أَهْلَهُ وَمِثْلَهُمْ مَعَهُمْ رَحْمَةً مِّنْ عِنْدِنَا وَذِكْرَى لِلْعَابِدِينَ. And we gave him back his family, along with others like them, as a mercy from us, and an admonition for the devout. Although this phrase, which is mentioned by the Holy Quran, quoting it from this afflicted righteous servant, does not contain any prayer, Allah the Exalted says, we answered his prayer and we removed his distress. It is as if presenting one's neediness and poverty is also a kind of supplication itself. Another instance is the righteous servants of Dhunnun. When he presents his indigence, neediness, and the wrong he committed against himself before Allah the Exalted from the darkness of the belly of the fish, and he was deep inside the sea. وَذَنُّونِ إِذْ ذَهَبَ مُغَاذِبًا فَظَنَّا لَنْ نَقْدِرَ عَلَيْهِ فَنَادَى فِي الظُّلُمَاتِ أَنْ لَا إِلَهَ إِلَّا أَنْتَ سُبْحَانَكَ إِنِّي كُنْتُ مِنَ الظَّالِمِينَ. The man of fish, when he left in a rage, thinking that we would not put him into hardship, then he cried out in the darkness, there is no God except you. You are immaculate. I have indeed been among the wrongdoers. فَاسْتَجَبْنَا لَهُ وَنَجَّيْنَاهُ مِنَ الْغَمِ. So we answered his prayer and we delivered him from the agony. وَكَذَلِكَ نُنْجِي الْمُؤْمِنِينَ. And thus do we deliver the faithful. So, as exhibiting neediness is a kind of prayer, similarly, the response and istijaba would not be to the petition, rather to the neediness and the indigence itself. In this case, Prophet Yunus alayhi salam did not utter more than these words, there is no God except you, you are immaculate, and I have indeed been from among the wrongdoers. But Allah answered him and delivered him from the agony and gham.
Why do we make supplication? And why do we call out to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Is it because God is not aware of our needs? God is Al-Alim. He knows all of our needs. Is it because God needs convincing? God is known as Al-Jawad. He is the source of generosity. Then why am I making dua to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? The dua is a journey of realizations. When a person goes to the ocean and he takes with him a bucket that can carry 4 liters of water, the ocean is infinite. In as much as your vessel is large, that is the amount of water that the ocean will give you. And therefore, our goal is to expand our capacity. Rumi has a very beautiful poem. He says, "Har khujo mushkil javab anjo ravad." Wherever there is a problem, that is where the answer will come. Har khujo kashti ab anjo ravad. Wherever there is a vessel, that's where the water will come. Ab kamju tishnagi avar bedas. Don't go seeking for water. Instead, create the thirst within you. Ta beju shad ab az bala va past. So that the water may burst forth from above and from below you. Experience that realization that you need God, and the mercy of God will come towards you. Paradise, thank you Allah, now that we're here, feeling so good, about all the things that we went through, knowing that God speaks with us too, it's not a dream, this is so true, and we know we'll be here forever.
The ocean of dua. So it is clearly inferred from these verses that neediness by itself is among the places of the Almighty Allah's mercy. And not only that, it is so important that understanding, recognizing, and comprehending this fact that you are from among the creatures, and not only that, but also you're from among the ones who are in need of the Almighty Allah, presenting this fact, exhibiting this fact before the Almighty Allah, is itself so important that it is counted somehow as a kind of supplication and dua. And that's why we have the instances throughout the verses of the Holy Quran and throughout the supplications of the infallibles, that they present this state of neediness and haja and indigence before the Almighty Allah, and the Almighty Allah has the answer. فَاسْتَجَبْنَا لَهُ, the Holy Quran says. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. وَالسَّلَامُ عَلَيْكُمْ وَرَحْمَةُ اللَّهِ وَبَرَكَاتُهُ.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
In the limelight.
American police violence is off the charts compared to other developed countries, with homicides occurring at a per capita rate almost 70 times that of the UK and nearly 170 times more than Japan, says Alan McLeod Ryder in an article titled Killer Cops. U.S. police killed over 1,000 Americans in 2020. Stay tuned, please, for the details. American law enforcement officers have killed well over 1,000 people in 2020. Between January 1st and December 15 of 2020, the Mapping Police Violence Project has recorded 1,066 people nationwide killed at the hands of the police, an average of around 3 killings per day. Despite the fact that 2020 has brought with it a pandemic forcing Americans to stay off the streets and presumably out of trouble as much as possible, there have only been 17 days recorded this year where the police did not kill someone. The project also compiled statistics on the racial backgrounds of the victims. Black people are 3 times more likely than white people to be slain by police and more likely to be unarmed when it does happen. 8 of the 100 largest city police departments kill black men at a higher clip than the U.S. murder rate. Those 8 are Reno, NV, Oklahoma City, Santa Ana, CA, Anaheim, CA, St. Louis, Scottsdale, AZ, Hialeah, FL, the Madison, and WI. Death by cop is a leading cause of death for black males in the U.S., killing 1 in 1,000. U.S. police violence is off the charts in comparison to other developed countries, with homicides occurring at a per capita rate almost 70 times that of the United Kingdom, or nearly 170 times more than Japan. This puts it closer to many Latin American nations, notorious for their corrupt and militarized police department's heavy-handed response to drug smuggling and organized crime. May 3rd was the deadliest day in 2020, with police killing 9 men in California, Colorado, Florida, Indiana, Kansas, North Carolina, and Texas. Perhaps the most infamous day came 3 weeks later, however, when police killed 7 men, among them 46-year-old African-American George Floyd. Floyd would likely have been as anonymous as the other 1,065 names on the list had the incident not been caught on camera and gone viral on social media, causing a worldwide uproar. Video showed Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin pressing his knee into Floyd's neck for nearly 9 minutes until he suffocated to death, even as onlookers pleaded with him not to kill him. Floyd's final words, "I can't breathe," became a rallying cry, sparking hundreds of large demonstrations nationwide. Between 15 and 26 million Americans are estimated to have attended at least one related protest in the subsequent weeks. As a response to the demonstrations, Chauvin was arrested and charged with second-degree unintentional murder and second-degree manslaughter. He was released on bail in October. However, his situation is unusual. Mapping police violence numbers show that only 1.7% of killer cops are ever charged with a felony, and far fewer are actually convicted, meaning there are very rarely any serious negative consequences for those that do kill while in uniform. The protests sparked a nationwide debate about the role of the police in the society, with polls showing that up to 39% of the U.S. approved of the measure to defund the police. Even more popular were actual police proposals of removing police responsibility for situations like mental health crises and homelessness, measures that would make up the backbone of any police defunding agenda. Despite being responsible for hundreds of brutality incidents during the subsequent protest and hundreds more attacks on journalists, police themselves claimed to be under assault. After a police officer was killed in Washington State in July, the institution's defenders suggested that the Black Lives Matter protests were morally responsible. Anytime the anti-police rhetoric heats up, it sends a message that it's open season on law enforcement. We saw it in 2016 and we are seeing it in 2020, a retired senior Secret Service agent told ABC News. Yet, the U.S. government's own data does not back this up. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, law enforcement is not a particularly dangerous profession. Virtually any other job performed mostly outside, from construction work and gardening to agriculture, fishing and forestry, all carry far more risk of death than being a police officer. Also more dangerous are professions where driving a vehicle, such as garbage collection, delivery driving or trucking, is a key component of the job. The 2020 presidential election was colored by the debate around police violence, with the incumbent president, Donald Trump, accusing Joe Biden of being in the pockets of radical anti-police leftists. In reality, however, Biden appeared hesitant to criticize the police at all, initially suggesting only that they shoot suspects in the leg rather than in the torso. The 78-year-old Delawarean also chose former prosecutor Kamala Harris, who described herself as California's top cop, as his running mate, all of which suggests that it is unlikely Americans will see a massive drop in police violence figures come 2021.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Martyr Soleimani is a champion of the Iranian nation and of the Islamic Ummah. This is the part of a speech delivered on December 16, 2020, by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the officials of Shahid Soleimani commemoration anniversary and with the family members of that great martyr.
The three branches of government should work and cooperate together, in particular the heads of the three branches. If such solidarity, unity and cooperation are realized, national unity will certainly be strengthened on a daily basis. Well, one can negotiate. There are or might be certain differences. You should resolve them through negotiations. You speak about negotiating with the world. Very well. How is one able to negotiate with the world? But not able to negotiate with domestic forces. You should negotiate with one another and resolve the problems. Some of the comments that we hear these days are a source of sowing discord, not unity. The fourth and the last point, I have said this before as well, but I wish to repeat it again. Lifting the sanctions is in the hands of the enemy. But counteracting them is in our hands. Is this not the case? We cannot lift the sanctions on our own. It is the enemy who should do so. However, we ourselves are capable of counteracting the effects of his sanctions. Therefore, this takes priority and is the right course of action. We should follow the latter move.
Your light and love, all I see. Nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
Yeah.
course, I am not saying that we should not be after lifting the sanctions. If we are able to lift the sanctions, we should not delay it, even for an hour. Of course, there is a four-year delay. Since year 1395 of the solar calendar, they have been intending to lift them all at once. But until today, not only have they not lifted, but they have also increased these sanctions. However, if we can lift them in a correct, reasonable, dignified, Islamic and Iranian way, we should do so. Nonetheless, you should not think too much about this. You should rather think about counteracting sanctions, which is an issue in your hands, as you are capable of doing it. And you should follow the matter and cooperate with one another in a diligent manner. This is my advice to you. I will support the officials of the country, but provided that they are committed to the nation's goals. I hope that Allah the Exalted will bestow on all the officials of the country the blessing to be able to accomplish great feats. God willing, greetings be upon you and Allah's mercy and blessings.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to
www.parstoday.com/en.